Calling the meek and the humble, welcome to Blackboard Jungle. Hello, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the talk show that gives music and films and books and TV too a bit more attention than is probably healthy. I'm Andrew Harrison, and on this week's show, we'll be looking at the TV adaptation of Margaret Atwood's much-revered feminist science fiction novel, The Handmaid's Tale, now running on Channel 4. It stars Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men fame as Offred, a chattel woman imprisoned for breeding purposes in a future America remade by religious fundamentalism. Does the TV version capture the world and the rage that Atwood put into her book? And how do you get a 7-part series, plus apparently another series on order, out of a powerful but slim book set in a world where, by definition, nothing ever changes? We'll be listening to new albums by ethereal gossamer, diaphanous breakup pop band Cigarettes After Sex, and also Noga Erez. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Noga Erez, the Israeli singer-producer that we're calling the Björk of Tel Aviv. Which of them will soundtrack your hazy summer, and can they also soundtrack your summer hangovers? And as the nation reaches the thrilling climax of the most tedious election since Claire from Modern Family ran for City Council, we'll be looking at the shocking ban on an anti-Theresa May record called Liar Liar by a band called Captain Scar, and wondering why processed records are so terrible. Plus, as is the custom, we'll be asking our guests to play their favourite tunes of the moment, in which case we should probably say hello to them. She is the deputy editor of The Guardian Guide, which means she's responsible for what you get up to all week, and a free-range pop culture writer who's covered everything from Ray Sremmurd to James Van Der Beek from Dawson's Creek lately. And she DJs on Worldwide FM too. It's great when you're Kate. Yeah, it's Kate Hutchinson. Hello, how are you today?
Hi, I loved that intro.
Well, there you go.
I love it when people rhyme my name.
Well, it's a good one. It's one of the great rhymes available, isn't it?
It is. It's easy to write. It's easy to, you know, do lots of things with.
And you can substitute a numeral 8 in there if you wish. So at the Guardian Guide, you worry that you have the whole world of everybody's week of fun in your hands, this awesome responsibility of what you're going to be getting up to.
Oh yes, it's a crushing responsibility, Andrew. I feel, you know, under pressure to be able to cover. I mean, the Guardian Guide is very small. It's very pocket sized. Put it in your handbag, you know, easily slotted down the side of the sofa. And so it is difficult to be able to fit everything that's going on because there are so many great things happening all around the country. I mean, it's a nationwide mag.
Let's be honest, though, it's the reason why people buy The Guardian on a Saturday, isn't it? Why don't you just sell it on its own for £3 and save loads of paper?
That would be an excellent idea.
A very diplomatic nodding going on here. He's a contributing editor to Mojo. He's a writer for the Sunday Times, Sight and Sound, and The Guardian. He's also number 19 on the Bromborough Gazette list of the most powerful people from the world. Hello, Andrew Mayle. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm very relaxed after my week in Devon. I care naught for London matters.
One night in Devon, yes. So apart from that, before you went off to recharge your batteries and just get it together in the country, what have you been covering lately? What have you been up to lately?
I've been covering just on a piece for The Guardian, which I think is going in this weekend, about this one guy in Ireland who basically puts on kind of amazing sort of classical music sort of festivals, and he's basically kind of does it all by himself from his bedroom. And yeah. So you have all these kind of, like, you know, that Arvo Pärt sleeping in his son's bedroom while he's over, you know, performing and things like that. Wow. He's incredible. So there's a little piece on him.
Now, I noticed on the Twitter front, you, like a lot of people, hit rather hard by the demise of John Noakes this week.
There
was a beautiful thing, Beta, the cheeky kind of make your own GIF community on the internet. They did a thing of let's commemorate John Noakes, and it was a lovely one. It was just an image of John and Shep on a hill, and the caption just said, "Where to now, lad?"
Heartbreaking
stuff. Yeah. You know, well, I mean, I've seen a few old, weirdly, I tend to see old Blue Peters as extras on Doctor Who DVDs. They have old Blue Peters on them. The astounding thing is that you see how old kids' television is actually more mature than adult television now. There's no inverted commas around it. There's no kind of, hey, we're all being ironic.
And there's no kind of special voice that they employ or anything, you know, for the children.
Yeah, I just thought we had to mention Noakesy once in the podcast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You heard his voice earlier, a minute ago. Also with us in the studio, it's our producer, the Biddy Baxter of podcasts. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Did you hear Biddy Baxter being interviewed on the Today programme?
Is Biddy Baxter still around?
Yeah, isn't that incredible that she's still with us?
And she was brilliant because John Humphreys was, you know, asked her about John Noakes and then was just kind of trying to go, because, of course, you wouldn't be able to do that now, would you? And isn't it a shame about kids' TV? And she was really, you know, for a woman who's obviously, you know,
300 years
old.
Yeah,
precisely. In her 80s, she was like, well, I really hate looking back and nostalgia, John. And he was going, yeah, but kids' TV nowadays. And she was like,
because I reckon Humphreys watches loads of kids'
yeah,
TV.
Yeah, but he would obviously be, you know, this was the angle he was going, and she just wasn't having any of it. And there was, you could, she was very pleasant, but you could see there was a bit of steel still there.
Yeah,
the kind of
definitely.
Steel that would
she was
send somebody
cookie, wasn't she?
up. Nelson's column without a harness.
Could you imagine thinking Humphreys needs to go up Nelson's column right now?
Yes,
harness.
I think that was it. Yeah.
Now, Matt,
yeah.
one quick thing. You've had a busy week because we have launched another podcast, haven't
we? We have, yeah.
And it's called Remainiacs.
It's called Remainiacs.
Tell the listeners what it's all about.
It's about Brexit, and it is for the people who were. The slogan is we're going to own the Ramon because everyone's being very balanced and sensible about it. And actually, we're more the howl of pain, this thing. We will not let this stand.
We will not let it lie. Yes. Yeah. We're not going to shut up and get over it.
Definitely not.
So if you're interested in that, after you've listened to Big Mouth, you can hear Remainiacs at audioboom.com/channel/Remainiacs. That's Remain, spelled properly, with an IACS on the end. And, of course, you can subscribe to it on the iTunes
not
Music.
Not yet.
So,
not yet, because the man, we've got problems with
we've
iTunes.
We've got problems with the man.
Yeah,
all right,
being,
well.
We're being... Our voice is not being heard.
Okay, well, listen to it on Audio Boom and then listen to Big Mouth again to cheer yourself up after thinking about politics. Anyway, let's get started. The adaptation of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale by the US network Hulu started on Channel 4 this week. It is a bleak and dystopian tale set in a future America where women are reduced to the status of property. Sales of the book rocketed when Donald Trump won the US presidency in November. Funny that. It's become a massive cliche to describe the show as timely. What does it have to say about the way we're going? And can a series about the oppression and abuse of women ever be entertaining in the conventional sense? We'll talk about it after this, which appears over the credits of episode 1. This is Leslie Gore and You Don't Own Me.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of you. Don't tell you what to do.
Yeah, but when are you going to have a handman's tale, eh? That's what I want to know. That was Leslie Gore with You Don't Own Me. Not exactly the theme from the show, but it does encapsulate everything that's disappeared from the world with the advent of the totalitarian regime of Gilead, the future America portrayed in the show. Kate Hutchinson, this one's been all over The Guardian. The Guardian is absolutely insane for The Handmaid's Tale. What did you make of it?
Yeah, and rightly so. Mm. Sometimes I don't like to add to the clamour, but for this, I couldn't. I was totally blown away by it. Really was. I do agree that it's the best thing on TV this year. It's smart, it's funny, despite
the surprise is that because there's little humour in the book. The book is incredibly bleak, surprisingly.
Yes.
And yet there are little sparks of humour in this that really light it up.
Yeah, I think that the voiceover that Offred / June gives, I think the voiceover that she has gives it this slightly lighter edge, which I think you need when, like you said, it's so oppressively bleak, and the creeping dread that you feel throughout it. I mean, I was really, really on edge. I walked home from my friend's house after watching it the other night, and I did genuinely feel a little bit shifty, a little bit on edge.
Yeah.
I felt like something had changed, because you feel like that could, it doesn't feel like so far away, the idea of these things happening.
Well, that's the way it looks. It's filmed, I believe, in Toronto and there's bits of the sort of more bucolic bits of Canada.
Mm.
And it's not one of these science fiction series where everything is replaced by a gigantic CGI cityscape.
Yes, exactly.
The costumes are clearly, every woman dresses according to her station.
Yes.
And, well, pretty much, so are the men as well. They're either the militia or they are the commanders. So everybody's been slotted into this position in a well-ordered society. But everything else looks the same, and you kind of think this could happen tomorrow. Andrew Mayle, what did you make of it?
I thought it was amazing. I mean, kind of the book's epigraph is, you know, once upon a time, a country went wrong.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I know everyone's been throwing around the word timely, but, you know, you've basically got this book where the Constitution is replaced by the Old Testament. And I think one of the things that's amazing about it is how clear that this is a country that's already rooted in slavery and patriarchy.
Yeah.
The thing that you pointed out, Offred or Elizabeth Moss's kind of performance, but also the fact that the ways in which it differs from the book actually, I think, make it better. They certainly, you know, they've updated it brilliantly. And one of the things that they seem to have done is combined Offred and Offred's mother in the book.
Yeah.
She's the sort of, you know, feminist sort of protester and everything.
Yeah.
And Offred in the book is much more sort of subjugated and subdued.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got that activism and wit from her previous life that you keep flashing back to and that you get in the voiceover means that you really care about this person. Yeah. And I think the other thing that they've done, which I think improves it, improves on the book or makes it a brilliant adaptation, is in the book, I think there's a, you know, kind of they basically send off all the people of colour to another colony. And here you've got, you know, kind of people of kind of, you know, different genders and different, you know, different colour. And I think that sense of it kind of purposefully being a portrait of America sort of 1 year or 6 months from now, you know, in the very slight future, I think is incredibly powerful.
That's Andrew Mail on behalf of the entire male gender there discussing Handmaid's Tale case.
I think what also adds to this sense of, you know, prescience is that the idea, and you get this in later episodes, I don't want to ruin it for anybody that hasn't seen those, but these flashbacks to how America or how the people in Handmaid's Tale kind of sleptwalked into radicalism. You build up these pieces of what happened and what happened to the country and how this came to be and how Gilead came to take over. And this idea that people were aware that something was happening, but didn't really sort of feel it immediately. There wasn't so much immediacy. It sort of slightly creeps in, this idea of radicalism, this idea of something, a different power, a different being taking over, and that I found really quite unsettling as well.
It is actually, to an extent, it is a push to describe it as a science fiction work, isn't it? Because there's only the only science fiction element really is a kind of John Windermy thing that this is all brought about by a collapse in fertility, which is brought about by pollution and, you know, non-specific bad science things have happened. And it's that little tiny thing that changes the world. And to me, you know, being a nerd, you know, it's like, you know, mature science fiction involves a very small thing that alters everything. Immature science fiction tends to involve massive changes, space operas, spaceships, you know, robot invasions, all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
But this is where it kind of zeroes in, and you kind of think this actually probably this could well happen.
Yes.
I mean, it's only really science fiction in the same way that that 1984 is science fiction. It's kind of dystopia rather than you know, there hasn't been an alien invasion or something escaping from a lab.
That's coming in season two.
it's kind of a parallel text to sort of Ruth Rendell's Children of Men, isn't it? And you can see that kind of they've purposefully almost tried to not avoid those connections in kind of how the sort of colour stock of the film, how the TV series looks, is very similar to how Children of Men looks and how it was shot. I think obviously Ruth Rendell's book was inspired by The Handmaid's Tale. So all those kind of points of crossover. I mean, the other thing that I like is kind of the way in which the book and the adaptation are kind of very purposefully rooted in, you know, American history. You can see parallels with like The Scarlet Letter or Shirley Jackson's The Lottery or something. And so it's basically this idea that this is a thread that already runs through American fiction. This is a thread that already runs through American
history. And even The Crucible. You know,
yeah, exactly. You see, yeah. So it's kind of, that's why it's even more terrifying, because you can see, you know, the lines of continuity through American history.
Yeah. Kate, you mentioned Elizabeth Moss' performance. What do we make of her?
I just think she's just incredible. She's like Jodie Foster. You know, it's all in her eyes.
Yeah.
The eyes acting. I don't know if there's a better phrase that anyone can come.
Ocular.
The ocular. Yeah.
Ocular thespianism.
Yeah. Nailed it. In The Handmaid's Tale is incredible, especially in I think it's Alexis Bledel's character as well, who plays her best friend, her friend that she walks to and from the shop with every day. Or we're not sure if they're friends in the first episode.
So they're
off Glen. Thank you.
Ofsted.
I'm excellent with names. The performance, her performance is really incredible. You really feel for her. You really feel her desperation when her daughter is ripped from her. And I think this also feeds into this idea that TV isn't a really, what The Handmaid's Tale represents in terms of exciting, complex, interesting female characters on television. Like you were saying, Andrew, ones that you really root for her, you really believe in her. And I just think that you can kind of almost feel that it was made by women, and that so much care was taken into making the show.
It's a male showrunner, isn't it? But I think he worked really close with Margaret Atwood, because he basically brought all the changes that he said we need to make and kind of went through them all with her.
Yeah.
And she kind of, you know, okayed pretty much everything. Yeah. The thing you're saying about Elizabeth Moss, it's incredible about the eyes, but also, and I very rarely point this out about an actor, the neck. because the thing is that she's so good at keeping all this anger in, and there's like a couple of scenes where you can't even see it in the eyes because she's obviously not allowed to show it in the eyes in front of her owners, so it's all kind of in those little neck muscles.
You're totally right, the bulge.
Yeah, incredible.
You mentioned Atwood working closely with the showrunner. Did you see the blink and miss it, you'll miss it
appearance by Mrs. Atwood herself?
Yes. Yeah.
No, where is she, what does she do?
She slaps June off Fred in the
Atwood. That's one of the horrible ants.
My wife went like, that's Margaret Atwood. Yeah. She's got the hair. Yeah. And it was. It totally was.
God. Now, there's two massive set pieces in the first one. Strangely, the first episode seems to encapsulate about 75% of the book, doesn't it? It seems most of what happens in the book happens in the first episode. There's two big set pieces. There's the ceremony, the sort of hideous sort of attempted forced impregnation of Offred in this bizarre ritualised proxy sex thing. And then there's the participation where the women basically beat a rapist to death. I don't think that's much of a spoiler. I think that's going to happen in a kind of very stylized, ritualized thing. And you see, for a minute, the women are allowed to do anything they want for 1 minute. Mm. And the outpouring of hatred and rage all taken out on this guy, to me, that kind of accentuated the thing that the show conveyed enormously well was what it feels like to be crushed and to have your 1 minute to when you take revenge on... a figure who is, you know, only represents what's been done to you in a very small way. And it's particularly chilling to see Offred really weighed in.
Which is a change from the book. In the book, I think it's Offglen who puts the first kick in, and Offred is like this kind of shocked observer of it. But I think it's kind of another way in which they've kind of changed it from the book that's kind of improved it. Because, you know, in a way, Offred has to be the centre here. You have to kind of... And that thing that we were talking about, all that, you know, in the eyes and in the neck, all that held in rage, that it comes out at that point is incredibly powerful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the book, she's sort of like this kind of helpless leaf carried down this stream of totalitarianism, isn't it? And obviously, they've had to reconceptualise the whole thing because we've got 7 episodes and clearly some plot is about to happen, some things are about to occur.
Well, the point about what happens with the second series, if you have that freedom of kind of moving away from the adaptation, how scarily does it kind of say, you know, where people say, oh, let's put another action sequence in here. Let's, you know, the danger of it becoming something like Game of Thrones could be problematic the longer it carries on.
Yeah. Case, where do you think they can take it in series 2? I mean, if the arc of it is what's going to happen to Offred, where can this thing go?
Well, weirdly enough, I haven't reread the book and I can't actually remember what happens, which adds to my stress because I don't know who survives and who dies. And I really like to know these things ahead of time. But I'm imagining that Offred escapes in the book, doesn't she? So I'm imagining that there would be...
It's slightly open-ended. You sort of think she might, or she may or may not.
Right. So perhaps they'll, you know, perhaps it goes Hunger Games and she turns into the kind of Katniss character where she returns with a sword, you know, and kind of tries to take them all on herself.
I'm sort of hoping
army.
Not, actually.
I am too. Yeah. But, you know, that could happen.
Yeah. And just finally on this one, I mean, I mentioned earlier, is it possible to enjoy a programme as harrowing as this? I mean, we watched it in total, you know, knuckle-gnawing silence.
Yes.
Is it possible to enjoy something like this?
I think it's enjoyable in that it's so refreshing and beautifully put together, beautifully shot. I think the cinematography is really amazing, the blood red of their clothing. And like we were saying earlier about the light humour, I really think without that it would be just an awful kind of, you know, an awful watch. But that and the pop music that's thrown into it at the right times, that kind of is the light to the shade. I think
it's certainly a different way to spend your Sunday night than watching Midsummer Murders, then, isn't it? They're really going to set you up for the working week with a smile on your face.
But I think we're almost so used to these kind of harrowing watches now, what with crime drama being so massive, things like Broadchurch. People almost are sort of ready for that. We almost expect it now. Yeah. For something to be just painfully grim and relentingly grim.
Well, we need cheering up now, so let's move on to a bit of music. Every week we ask our guests to bring in a tune that they are enjoying at the moment, their editor's recommendation. Kate Hutchinson, what have you got for us?
I have picked a track called 707, which is the title track of a re-release by Umoja, who, and it's come out on Awesome Tapes in Africa, who are this brilliant label run out of New York that go and dig up loads of old tapes from Africa and re-release them. like the name suggests. And this was a South African bubblegum music group. And it's got such an excellent energy to it. I don't actually think it's that bubblegum. I think it, and I also think it sounds weirdly modern.
Yeah.
I would DJ this in a set alongside, you know, something that was released yesterday.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Umoja and 707. Umoja and 707, as chosen by our guest Kate Hutchinson. And we're going to stick with music and two of the week's more interesting releases. Noga Erez is a Tel Aviv-born musician and producer whose debut album Off the Radar is out this week. She makes electronic music in one of the world's most conflicted and contested regions, and the album looks at that clash of European comfort and civil democracy with the exigencies of living on a political fault line. We're going to have a listen in a minute, but let's start with Cigarettes After Sex, founded in El Paso, Texas, and centred on the androgynous voice of Greg Gonzalez. They've been together since 2008 and are a proper slow burner, but expectations for their self-titled debut album are high. Here is a taster. This track is called Each Time You Fall in Love. Cigarettes After Sex from the Chainsmokers. That was Cigarettes After Sex with Each Time You Fall in Love from their debut album. Getting a strong Galaxy 500 Mazzy Star Sparkle Horse vibe off that one. Andrew Mayle, did it float your boat?
Not at all. Well, I mean, the thing that I initially pulled away from, and I have to be honest, I would always pull away from a band called Cigarettes After Sex.
Yeah.
because it's that, I know we, in the world of music journalism, you always try not to use the word sophomore, you know, it's sort of meaning kind of, you know, that second year at university where you think you're incredibly sophisticated and cultured because you've seen, you know, Fitzcarraldo and you've got a Man Ray poster on your wall. And it seemed to occupy that world. We're going to call our band Cigarettes After Sex. Yeah. But also, I mean, that you make a good point. They almost sound like a lot of bands I like. Scritti Politti, Cocteau Twins, Mazzy Star, Pet Shop Boys, Cleontel. But he also sounds like that terrible fey folk idiot from the 70s, Al Stewart. And that's what kind of kept coming through. But
he's
I think...
Year of the Twat.
Very good. I think there's something a bit creepy and stalkery about him. I mean, there's all his songs sound the same. They're all really unresolved and dull. But it's all his lyrics are all like, all of my love for you cuts me like a barbed wire and always keep you in my room, in my life, in my little box under the bed. You know, there's something kind
that's
of...
To be fair, to every guy.
He doesn't actually sing them in that
voice. No.
But to be fair.
So I don't like the kind of, you know, look at my hip cultural references. I don't like the lyrics. I also don't like the fact that his songs never resolve themselves. They've always got like these... I think what you call them passing chords, then you never get to the tonic chord. So the thing that's great about the Cocteau Twins is there's always that point where there's a crescendo, where there's a chordal shift and you go, this is amazing, I'm on drugs.
The pop is a clock moment.
And his just go on and on and on, and they never reach that crescendo. They never reach that point of resolution. I did not like this record.
So qualified, yeah. Kate Hutchinson, what did you make? I mean, because, the rich vein of cosmic floaty, very slightly smacky alternative pop. We haven't had that much of it lately. What did you make of this
one? Smacky alternative pop, yes, my favourite music genre. I love Mazzy Star, but I did not love this either. I think aside from the... hip cultural references that you said. Yeah, the lyrics, there's a track Young and Dumb where he talks about hot chicks with no clothes on. And I can't work out whether he's being sort of willfully sarcastic.
Being
with
ironic,
this. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I hate it. Yeah. I also think there's this this weird, there's a lot of music that sounds like this, and it's like Twin Peaks kind of sex music, or like people have gone out.
Well, see, they call is it that Twin your Peaks second, sex music. We're all, you know,
is that your second favourite musical genre?
Yes, that is. Yeah, second on my iTunes or my Spotify. No, I feel like there's this sort of weird thing where bands like go out and they set out this intent, like, oh yeah, it's Twin Peaksy, like, and I think people might say that about Cigarettes After Sex, like, oh yeah, it's really Twin Peaksy. But like, what is What is that?
Actually mean?
What does that mean?
What does that even mean?
And what does that even mean, guys? I think his voice, I mean, you said Al Stewart, I thought a bit Erland Doyle from Kings of Convenience.
Yes.
But the thing is about his voice, unlike someone like Mazzy Star, for example, it doesn't have a depth to it. It has a detachment. I'm really obsessed with voices, and his has this kind of callous detachment in the song. So not only does the song not crescendo, but his voice doesn't go anywhere.
It does have that odd quality of being sort of sexually indeterminate. You can't quite, you know, it's sort of high enough to be potentially sort of the classic breathy female, and yet he is. A lot of the lyrics, and you pointed out Young and Dumb, a lot of it is genuinely creepy, sort of stalkery and slightly nasty.
Yeah. I have a feeling that it's irony in the sense of someone like Conan Mochinson or Ariel Pink, in that sort of, you know, we're fey, so we're allowed to get away with being creepy. That sort of vibe. I mean, I haven't looked at his picture, but that's what I'm imagining.
It doesn't look like Elizabeth Fraser, I'll tell you that.
But the Cigarettes After Sex, they're also in The Handmaid's Tale. One of their tracks is used, I think, later on. I read an article that's talking about the use of pop music in Handmaid's Tale.
They do strike me as a girls band. As a band that would be...
What does that mean,
Lena
Matt?
No, that would be Lena Dunham.
Oh, I see.
Oh, right. Really? Really? Like a band for girls.
No, they don't have enough bollocks band for that. She likes, you know, music with hard, heavy balls.
See, I sort of quite liked it in the sense that it had a nice feel to it. And I think what you're saying about unresolved, I think that's actually a feature these days and not a bug. You know, people want unresolved music for some reason because you can plug your own feelings and thoughts into it. You don't want to be told something. You just want to have something that, you know, can be an accessory to your own thought processes. Kate, you're frowning and wincing at me.
No, I'm considering it. I don't know whether Cigarettes After Sex is still something where you can add your own interpretation because the lyrics seem to be quite specific to me. If you're talking in terms of this sort of atmosphere, this flirty atmosphere, I mean, we're not all about to, like, you know, light a doobie and sit on a beanbag and, like, float away in this kind of mess of... I mean, where would you listen to this music? Where is this...
Really?
Right.
There you go, there's your answer.
Where is this appropriate music to add your own...
Do people still have dinner parties? I don't know.
Dinner party music. The ultimate thing that any band wants to be called.
Oh, I like that about you. Okay, let's move on. Kate mentioned, you know, music with big balls. Well, here's some music with big balls. This is the Israeli producer singer Noga Erez from her own debut album, Off the Radar. This is the title track. Complete the typing sounds. This is Off the Radar.
Hear me, no one sees me, no one. Hear me, no one sees me, no one. I'm off the radar. Hear me, no one. Hear me, no one sees me, no one. Hear me, no one sees me, no one. I'm off the radar.
The avant-garde sound of Tel Aviv there, that was Noga Erez with Off the Radar. Now, Kate Hutchinson, you did a sizable piece with her for The Guardian, didn't you? What's the story with Noga Erez?
Yeah, for the Observer New Review. She is one of the most exciting pop artists, not just from there, but I think at the moment. And her music is quite political, and she's quite a sort of politically charged person. So Off the Radar, I believe I'm right in saying this, is about this idea that things are so politically confusing and so charged, and it's just there all the time, that you actually want to shut yourself away from it and actually live life as if there isn't this, like, awful things that are going on just, you know, 30 minutes down the road, which... I get the impression that that's what a lot of young Israelis feel. It's not that they're switched off from what's going on. It's that they feel powerless to change anything. So they just live their lives. They just continue to live their lives in the way that they can. She's a politically charged artist, and she's also an exciting pop artist. She makes interesting beats, like with typewriters.
Well, it is a massive cliche, isn't it, to describe any female artist with a broad palette as being a bit like Björk? But actually, she is a bit like Björk. You know, she does bring in those very sparse arrangements with a fat bass line that will come in from somewhere, like, you know, random sort of very distorted and deconstructed electronics, with her voice as a centerpiece, creating the world.
Yeah, I think her voice is really interesting. She sings in a sort of deadpan, sort of very low, sometimes even monotone. Mm. It sort of gives it a sort of sort of creeping, sort of a slight sort of ominous feel, I feel,
yeah,
with her voice. But I would say there's more. I mean, with that song in particular, there's the sort of Hudson Mohawk style squelching low horns, which I really like.
Yeah,
she's obviously got this sort of like MIA style kind of sing speak rap sort of thing going on also. So I think it's not just Bjork, but there's lots of different influences. Yeah. And she's also really into Kendrick Lamar and Frank Ocean, a lot of R&B, and I think the rest of the album brings in a lot more of those influences too.
Andrew Bell, what did you make of it?
I really liked it. I mean, you'd run a mile from something that was described as the Tel Aviv Bjork, and I don't think in that sense that the description does her a lot of favours, because I think with every Bjork track, Bjork is the centre of it. And I think the interesting thing about this is where she's kind of disassembling pop, and the pop singer is not at the heart of it. I mean, and to me, that my points of comparison with things like, you know, Flying Lotus or RP Boo, you know, kind of footwork stuff, with that are playing around with different kind of musical forms. But she's also playing around with her voice. She's playing around with sort of lyrics and vocal delivery. And these songs kind of, they're not as centered as a Bjork track. They feel precarious, disorientating in a way that's kind of, you feel like, for her and the listener. And I like that fact that your perception is disturbed. You've kind of got these sort of points that you'd hold on to in terms of what a pop song is, but it shifts. And I like the fact that on the album, the brevity of some of the more chilling songs, you know, tracks like Quiet One and Hit You, they're really disturbing, but they're really short. So she's also playing around with ideas of kind of song length, which you don't get. You know, you get very bored at a lot of records now where everything is 4.5 minutes to 7 minutes. And the fact that she's got some of these brilliant ideas that are kind of a minute long, and also the fact that some of the prettiest sounding tracks like Worth None or Global Fear are also some of the bleakest. Yeah. So the way in which she kind of plays around with your sense of perception is kind of, you know, it's very, almost very druggy. You know, I kind of think that a Noga Erez track is more at home in the world of The Handmaid's Tale, say, than that creep out of, you know, Cigarettes After Sex, you know, because it is that world of kind of like, I am living in a world that I can no longer make sense of, and all my points of kind of order have shifted. And the way that she does that within the pop format, I think, is fantastic.
Kate just mentioned the sort of the political context of the whole thing. You know, she's an Israeli artist, and obviously, you know, music fans and music lovers tend to be on the left, and there is, you know, this sort of you know, unthinking sort of institutional instant reaction to anything Israeli, which, you know, there's sometimes it's legitimate, sometimes it's just straight up anti-Semitic. And is she going to have to carry the can? Is she going to have to walk around with I am the Israeli artist? Is she going to be? I mean, because I looked at the tweets in response to your piece, and it was quite heartening that there was only a very small number of tweets that were expecting her to carry the can for the activities of the Israeli state.
Yeah, and I think it's so complex as well. So, you know, there's so many differing, you know, we tend to see it as sort of one versus the other. Mm. But within that, it's so complex. There's so many different ideas, and there's so many different takes, and there's so many different beliefs. So to expect one person to have one sort of unified voice, it's like if you expect a queer artist to speak for all queer people.
Yeah.
It's in a way, that's a sort of similar thing. And I think as she gets, or hopefully bigger, and her music gets out to more people, that will have to be something that she deals with more and more, I think, as she talks to more people. Or maybe people just won't bring it up with her.
Well, there's a real lightness of touch, isn't there? There's that song Pity, which has a kind of ever so faint martial drum beat going through it. And you just think that's a really, you know, for somebody who comes from a society where everybody has to do national service, that's a really interesting thing to kind of just weave in and out of.
Well, we might get into this later. The brilliance of it is that it's not on the nose. You know, there are no kind of like, and here I am singing about Israel. You know, it's like kind of what I was trying to say about the music. There is, you know, it is fuzzy. You know, kind of you're not sure where it sits. And I think that's its kind of genius. It's someone at the centre kind of not realising that they can't make clear on the nose statements in the world that they're living in.
I think that's really key. I think she's certainly, from talking to, she's singing from a personal place, but she's not trying to make grand sweeping statements about what's going on politically. She's speaking from her own personal experience as a young woman trying to make be creative in a place like she's living. And that, I think, is really key.
Okay, so we like that one. That's good. Okay, we're going to have another choice of music from another of our guests, Andrew Mail. What record have you brought in?
It's a track called The Workers Are on Strike by Karen Guire.
Yeah.
It's from forthcoming album, but I think this track already came out last month. And she's a Michigan born producer, moved to London from New York in the mid noughties. And kind of her first album was very kind of multi-layered, kind of contemplative, sort of diaphanous kind of techno. You know, there were kind of a voice, ghostly voices in there. And I think basically what's happened is she's gone out and played sets before the DJs come on, and everyone stood in front of her sets with their arms folded or sitting on beanbags, and she's been thinking, why is no one getting up and dancing? So she's kind of made this kind of, you know, in a way, this concept album about that, which is kind of, you know, in a way, a lot of the tracks are sort of hard-edged, sort of machine-tooled techno, but they've got these kind of, like what we were saying about Noga Erez, they've got these wrong-footing details. They've got the kind of strange embroideries. I think the whole album's fantastic, but this is the only track that we could play so far.
Okay, let's have a listen. This is The Workers Are on Strike by Karen Guire. Karen Guire with The Workers Are on Strike, as chosen by Andrew Mail. Now, you may have noticed that there's an election on. It is the most interminable and tedious in living memory. And you may have seen a very irate story about an anti-Theresa May single being banned despite going to the very top of the charts. Liar Liar by Captain Scar is number 2 on the iTunes chart, and yet national radio won't play it. Shock horror. It's the Sex Pistols at the Silver Jubilee. It's Ding Dong the Witch is Dead when Margaret Thatcher died, etc. Because the shadowy elite obviously knows that the pop charts are so powerful that MI5 must control them. Well, actually, it turns out the story isn't quite as exciting as that. Number 2 in the iTunes chart could mean anything from number 20 to number 1 million in the real chart. And you can't play records like this on the radio anyway during a campaign for reasons of impartiality. And also, by the way, is it any good? This got us thinking, why are explicitly political records never that much fun? Why was Wham Rap a much more exciting and subversive record than Kick Out the Tories by the Newtown Neurotics? Before we get into our least favourite political records, here's the one that got us thinking about it in the first place. This is Liar Liar by Captain Scar.
We have a mission to make Britain a country that works, not for the...
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar.
Think about it, yeah, that was Liar Liar by Captain Scar, with getting at least one radio play. Now, Andrew Mail, did that change your voting intention? Had you ever imagined that Theresa May was such a rotter?
The problem here is that I think we kind of touched on it earlier. It's the kind of on-the-nose-ness of political records, isn't it? It's like kind of this... Well, there's a lot of problems with them. One is kind of the fact that there's very little subtlety there, you know, and the other is the idea that kind of these people tend to think that they are somehow the spokesperson for our generation. And we need, you know, we were labouring under some delusion that she was, you know, this kind of wonderful saviour. And it only took Captain Scar to sort of, you know, divest us of this opinion. And I think this is the problem with kind of political sort of songs and political albums in general. I mean, the two, I picked some that kind of don't particularly like themselves, myself. And one of them is regarded as a classic. And it's kind of the album, The Nylon Curtain by Billy Joel, which is his kind of Beatles pastiche concept album about the life of baby boomers in Reagan's America. And it's got this track on it called Goodnight Saigon, which is meant to be one of his greatest songs, which has, you know, lyrics like... we came in spastic like tameless horses. We left in plastic as numbered corpses.
Think about it.
And it's not just the kind of that on-the-noseness of the lyrics. It's kind of, there's some kind of self-righteous contempt in Billy Joel's voice. And also there's a humorlessness. And I think that's also the problem with a lot of political records, that they are so dreary and po-faced. And also the fact, because of this kind of on-the-noseness, you tend to basically just get a list of cliches as if they're insights. Mm. There's nothing kind of, there's no, what you look for in in pop music is poetry. You look for a lyric that you cannot fully, completely unravel, so it will always stay with you. You do not get that with political records.
Okay, you were saying that you actually quite like that Captain Scar record.
I just think it's a bit of fun, isn't it? I think, you know, in the same way as people try to get Killing in the Name by Rage Against the Machine to topple the X Factor number one, I don't see anything wrong with this. And I can imagine it being banged out in one of the, you know, chai-wala tents in Glastonbury or whatever, chai tea tents, and people having a right laugh to it.
I would say in its defence that it's not pompous in the way that the Billy Joel track is pompous.
No.
Well, to me, the irony is that if anybody's going to like kind of warmed up, I like bouncing, boing, 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 Scar, it's probably UKIP voters in their Fred Perrys and their dad mod haircuts. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily hitting the market. But Matt, you were going to stand up for
I think that Scar as a form and as a musical style, you know, came from a time in Jamaica when there were a lot of records that were coming out describing and detailing the current political situation in kind of Kingston, especially, but on the whole island, you know. And so actually, it's in a long line of kind of quickly boshed out kind of session musos.
Let's be honest, those records were A, joyful, and B, an awful lot.
But yeah, but they're, well, you know, you I might mean, say
it's,
so.
It's
but
kind
you know,
of unfair,
the other thing is that these, I don't think that political records are intended. People don't make them thinking, oh yeah, this is going to change people's views. This is a support thing, you know. It's like there is never a, you know. I would even say Ghost Town is preaching to the converted.
I don't know. I think
with
Ghost
the possible
Town,
exception of obviously Eaton Rifles by the Jam, which obviously was picked up and mistaken by a lot of people.
I think Ghost Town and Nelson Mandela are the two kind of pinnacles of the political pop record because they did change people's minds, particularly Nelson Mandela. Because let's be honest, lots of people hadn't heard of Nelson Mandela before that was a hit. But I mean, to me, it's like what gets people going with a political pop record is joy and humour. Stand Down Margaret by The Beat is a joyful record with a cheeky message. How dare you tell a prime minister?
Well, you know, the people who will get into this will think this is being quite cheeky as well.
I'd need to be on whatever they're on to.
But I think there's a wider discussion here, isn't there? About, I mean, I thought that what defines a protest song is directness and specificity. So it's something that was about something, and you knew that it was about Vietnam from the lyrics. You knew that it was about Theresa May from the lyrics. But I was thinking about this, and I was wondering whether some of the protest songs that I think are more universal, the ones that you can apply to anything. So Standing in the Way of Control, for example, by The Gossip, is an incredible, angry, direct of a record. You know, you're stompy. And that could be against any kind of control. So which is better, I suppose?
Well, I think Standing in the Way of Control is, first and foremost, a fantastically exciting record. It's a total blow your lid off piece of excitement, which is, you know, compounds the message rather than just is a platform for it. But you know, we were talking before about like choosing your least favourite ones. What are your least favorite political records?
Well, I mean, political, I would say in the loosest sense, but I'm really into climate bangers at the moment after Inoni's record last year. So I was thinking about Earth Song. I went back onto YouTube and I looked at the video of Earth Song, and I really thought that in kind of direct opposition to the definition of what I just said the protest song was, this is a song that was so general, someone said on the internet, you cannot mistake it for anything other than bullshit. And I mean, there's no real way of singing about elephants without sounding really really over the top and earnest, and obviously the whole kind of messiah complex in it was very problematic. And so I think, you know, climate songs are really difficult to get right, but the way that Inoni got it right was by taking on this sort of this destructive Mother Earth character. So it had this real sense of evil from her lyrics when she was talking about wanting to kill all the animals. So I think perhaps that's how you do it, you flip it.
Okay, well, we're kind of running tight on time now. I mean, my least favourites are Russians by Sting, obviously. It's very clear the Russians hate their children, so we should fight them. And much as I love the Specials, Racist Friend by the Special, a.k.a., is so hectoring and so kind of joyless, and it's counterproductive. If you've got a friend who's a racist, why would you not try to persuade them not to be a racist? Instead of just binning them off. Andrew, I think you've got another one as well, haven't you?
It's Bosnia by the Cranberries. But it's just kind of, it's when you write a protest song and you're not very bright. That's all you can say about that.
Okay, well, we're at the end of the show, and that means it's time for closing time chatter. This is the part of the show where our guests tell us what has been filling their mind this week. Kate Hutchinson, I believe you're interested in DJs going classical.
I will keep it brief for you. I think that I really love I'm really interested in classical music and electronic music crossing over, but in recent, in the last year, there seems to be this real kind of influx of nostalgia classical events, like the Hacienda Classical. It's apparently awful at Royal Albert Hall a couple of weeks ago. As Pete Tong's doing his Ibiza Classics last year. Sasha recently did something with strings at the Barbican. It's too much, guys. Mm. It's stop trying to prove that you're... I think it was interesting before when especially black Detroit techno DJs were doing a lot of stuff at Kevin Saunderson, were doing stuff with...
Well, Jeff Mills had a fantastic orchestral thing, which was really...
Exactly, really exciting, but also because that's the context of it as well. It's like, you know, going into these lofty spaces, and I feel like it's subversive. But with the this other end of it, the Pete Tong end of it, I feel it's really just sort of squeezing on us gold nostalgia grapes in a really cringy way.
Yeah. Well, dance music is supposed to be good, moronic, bashy brain music, isn't it? Stop trying to make us clever DJs. No, intelligent dance music, no, stupid dance music.
Bosh in the corner.
Absolutely.
There.
Andrew Mayle, what have you got for us?
Well, I think we should also go back to vegetarianism, natural healing and nudism. I've been reading this. There was this article on freeze.com by a woman called Lyra Kilston, which is about the LA Nature Boys, which was a group of German immigrants at the start of the 20th century who started this proto-hippie commune in Palm Springs. And there's fantastic pictures of them. They look like sort of 60s hippies, and the pictures are from like 1914. And they base their philosophy on this thing called Lebensreforms. It's late 19th century German cultural movement. But it was also the late 19th century German cultural movement that fed into the Nazis.
So naked vegan Nazis. Great.
So it's kind of this idea that kind of over in sort of industrial Germany, you have this philosophy that gives you Hitler, but over on the west coast of America, you have this philosophy that gives you Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
And who's just the best? Only one way to find out.
Fight.
Yeah. LA Nature Boys, delightful. Matt Hall, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
I was going to talk very seriously about how great the BBC's big weekend in Hull was, but I'd much rather now talk about how, since Donald Trump's bizarre tweet earlier this week, which had the word covefe in it, there have been a number of covefe Twitter feeds springing up, including Covefe the Strong, who's a Viking warrior, has been brought back from the summoned back from the 12th century. Covefe the Magician, who wants to get his hands on the globe, that
the orb.
Yeah. And now these two, I don't know whether they've been set up by the same person, but they're now arguing about.
They're doing battle, over the rights to Covefe.
A magic wall that came. Amazing. Well, wake up and smell the Covefe. mine is a quick one. I mean, obviously, we're all talking about it. It's Les Dawson's obscure science fiction novel, A Time Before Genesis, as brought to light in a review in the latest issue of 40 and Times, The Journey of Strange Phenomena. Friend of the podcast, Justin Robertson, told me about this. The book concerns a conspiracy of immortal Nazis who murdered JFK and Marilyn Monroe, and the man who investigates them while working on the Huddersfield Courier. It takes place in the dystopian, far distant future of 1995, when the state owns all the pubs and the banks, Prince Charles and the Pope have been exiled, and Aryan Nazis carry out a Lovecraftian reign of terror. This is all from the man who invented Sissy and Ada. Like, this is an astonishing book written by Les Dawson, available only now. You can only get it for like incredibly rare copies, about £110 each. So I'm thinking of setting up a crowdfunding and a lending library via Big Mouth, where we can get a copy of A Time Before Genesis by Les Dawson, and we can all elevate our consciousness through the medium of Les's science fiction visions. Okay, well, we're at the end of the show. Before we go, we've just got time for one quick commercial message. This Sunday, the 4th of June, I will be interviewing the two Thargs, the alien editors of 2000 AD comic, at the Stoke Newington Literary Festival. Steve McManus was the editor in the 1980s, the heyday of Nemesis, Halo Jones and Rogue Trooper. He'll be signing copies of his memoir of working at 2000 AD. It's called The Mighty One. And current editor Matt Smith will explain how the Rebellion Games Company brought 2000 AD back from the dead in the early noughties. And you can get your tickets at StokeNewingtonLiteraryFestival.com. And I'll see you there. So that's our show in the bag. Another one. Thanks to our guest, Kate Hutchinson. Thanks for coming down. Please come again.
I'd love to come again. We'll have to schedule it 6 months in advance, like this time again.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this one has been it's been like trying to find a slot in the Queen's diary. So we've finally done it. So we'll see you in 2018 or something. Yeah. And Andrew Mayle, thanks again for coming in.
Yeah, I'm available next week.
Fantastic. We'll do another one right here. Remember, dear listener, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again, and you can hear all of our past shows at your heart's content at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. And of course, you can subscribe in the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, where we would be delighted if you could leave us a star rating as well. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye.